Hello, and thank you for joining us and listening to the Web Talk Guys radio show. My name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Web Girl Dana. We're trying to bring you the inside peek into the future of the internet every week. Today on the show, we'll be discussing the true globalization of the internet and really the future of websites that support many languages and many cultures and address naming to truly make web information globally accessible. We'll be talking with the net boss, the ICANN.org president and CEO, Stuart Lin.
The internet, by its very definition, is very diffuse and distributed. That's one of its great, great strengths historically. But there are certain things that need to be coordinated in some central way, and ICANN is dealing with those aspects as far as addressing and naming is concerned. So, no, we don't run the internet, and there are lots of things that ICANN is not involved in. We're relatively well-defined in our scope, and we try to keep within our scope.
We'll also speak with author and online community developer Derek Powazik as he shares with us the current and future state of online communities, and he'll also tell us what techniques and technologies are working best now to build successful online communities.
One of the most interesting areas of growth in the last year has been weblogs. Weblogs have expanded to include community features, comments, group weblogs where several people post, and they've become really focused areas for a particular niche. There's like ShowTunes weblog or Buffy the Vampire Slayer weblog.
All that ahead for you here at Web Talk Guys Radio. Some news around the net this week. High-end server sales are down, but low-end server sales are up. Rob?
We've seen a study according to Gartner DataQuest that sales of web servers and actual disk file servers this year overall have been up about 10% compared to last year, but the majority of the growth is in the purchase of low-end servers, which is a little bit of a twist there. Gartner DataQuest also reports that customers are focusing on less ambitious projects as the reason for the growth in the lower-end servers. We also have a list of the top manufacturers of servers out there.
And just in case you're looking to buy.
That's right. And there's been a little shuffle, and it was caused by the merger of Hewlett-Packard and Compaq. And that combination has moved into the first place position with about 30% of the market. And in the second place is Dell.
Dell, dude.
Actually, they're up about 2%, but they're still in second position at 18%.
Hmm. Then comes IBM, and in the fourth position, Sun Microsystems, which I always equated to making expensive servers, so maybe that's why. I don't know.
Well, that I always thought that Sun Microsystems really specialized in software, so I guess they kind of do both.
There you go.
Dana, you found a useful site for everybody out
there. Oh, I love this site. Now I found a new place to start typing in domain names, even though that's so 1990s to try and find domain names to buy. But go to deletedomains.com. That's the whole purpose of that site. And they instantly search a database of recently deleted domain names or domain names that are on hold. So all you do is use their online form. It lets you sort of select by how many characters you want to buy. Let's say you want a five-letter domain name, which is apparently hard
terrific.
To come by. Or keywords in it. Like you want to have something that says radio. I typed in radio. Came up with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pretty good ones, too, actually.
This has been a burning need for a long time, to a place to go to search for domain names that have recently come available. So I think this is terrific.
Mm.
We also want to say hi to Jeff from Indiana, Tom in Texas, and Jeff in Pennsylvania, and Gordon from China.
Wow.
As those guys recently subscribed to our weekly Web Talk Guys email newsletter. And I want to thank those guys for joining the Web Talk Guys family.
Mm.
And we also had a recent conversation with a fellow by the name of Bob Kay from Seattle. And he asked a great question and suggested a topic idea for the show through our new Web Talk text messaging board on our front page. Bob asked, so are you guys planning to do a show on the new subscription audio services like Listen.com, eMusic, MusicNet, Real Network, Superpass, Music Match, Subscription Radio? Can those guys really compete with the free Napster-style downloads? And that's what his question was. And Bob, yes, I think they can compete in the long run because, as it appears, the recording industry is plugging all those leaks out there pretty quickly. I think as Kazaa limits its access to free files online.
And, I use Kazaa all the time.
I think it's coming. Those companies will see a resurgence in their membership because people don't have any other alternatives. That concept of a show for us was a terrific idea, and thanks, Bob, for giving us that idea, and we will work hard to get Listen.com on the show soon.
And in fact, you must do what Bob did and go to webtalkguys.com and start talking in the little WebTalk JavaScript box. It's kind of like a little chat room right on the front page. You can't miss
it. Exactly. We want to hear from you.
Anytime anybody's on, they can just talk in real time to each other. You know, Rob, we need to take a quick shameless show promotional break.
We never do this.
Yeah, because we have such a good show coming up next week, so I wanted to give everybody a heads up. And if you're interested in getting ranked really highly in Google, and who isn't, you know, even if it's just getting your personal website, your name website, you need to mark your calendars for next Saturday, August 17. A New York Times writer is going to be on our show to talk about his Google obsession.
He was passionate about Google.
His goal was to get his personal name ranked at number one. Did he make it? We'll find out.
Stay connected, because in seconds we'll get connected to the head boss of ICANN at ICANN.org. And we're going to speak with ICANN's president and CEO, Stuart Lin. He's going to join us to explain ICANN's future role in the globalization of the internet. This is Web.Guys Radio. You're back connected to the Web Talk Guys radio show, and I'm Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Web Girl Dana. Now, this show is always striving to bring you the future of the internet. That's our tagline, after all.
Yes, it is.
We can't talk about the net's future without factoring in the involvement of ICANN. ICANN stands for the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, and they're at ICANN.org, I-C-A-N-N. Back in 1998, ICANN was created as a not-for-profit private company that is a unique experiment in the community coordination of the critical global resource, which is the Internet's naming and numbering system.
A very political environment. ICANN's key responsibilities are the domain name system out there, that's the .coms and the .nets of the world, and the allocation of IP address space, the management of the root server system, and the coordination of protocol number assignment. Safe to say that without them, the internet would not last long.
Not long.
That's right. Some of the issues facing us all, and ICANN in particular, is that the internet is running out of actual internet numeric addresses, and a new numbering system is being worked on right now. It's called IPv6. We are also looking at the explosive growth worldwide of the internet, and that creates a demand for a system of domain names that uses other languages like Chinese, Korean, Japanese, or Arabic. Joining us today to discuss the global internet is Stuart Lin, the president and CEO of ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. Previous to ICANN, Stuart was part of the founding Internet 2 Consortium as its initial director. He was also director of IBM's Houston Scientific Center. Stuart, thanks for coming on the show with us.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Why don't you give us a little background on how ICANN was formed and kind of what its role is?
Sure, by all means. ICANN was actually formed in 1998 following a long consultative process involving the U.S. government, governments around the world, and substantial segments of the internet community. The reason it was formed is that many of the functions that ICANN performed, if you look back in the history of the internet, were originally performed by one individual who was a much revered figure, John Postel. But as the internet commercialized in 1994 and as it spread and globally and became more complex, it was clear that the tasks we do were too complicated for just one person to handle. It needed an organization that could bring together all the various constituencies, many of whom were and still are loggerheads with each other, and fashion a policy out of that. Now, let me just talk about what we do, because it's often a little obscure and people don't always understand it. What we're really responsible for is coordinating the technical issues and policy issues that surround those technical issues that deal with the naming and addressing systems on the internet. So those systems that enable you to put in www.cnet.com or whatever and make sure that predictably and reliably you get to where you want to go, no matter where you are in the world and what time you're doing it. So we have a very narrow but important role in coordinating certain functions on the internet that require global coordination if they're going to function properly.
And why do we need ICANN from a bigger sense?
Well, you know, here's why you need ICANN. If you're a user, You want to make sure that when you send email to your Aunt Sally, it doesn't end up with my Uncle Juan, or that when you put in www.cnet.com, as I indicated, anywhere in the world, it should work predictably and reliably in the way you expect it. And why you need ICANN is to ensure that all the many complicated questions that lie underneath what seems on the surface to be something very simple and direct, all these questions are properly addressed and answered. These things work properly.
So now, where is the ICANN organization based, and is it truly a global organization? Do you have a reach with all the countries of the world that help monitor these policies and help negotiate those things?
We do. We're actually located, our headquarters in Marina del Rey, California, not too far from Los Angeles Airport. We're a small organization with a strong global reach. Actually, 13 of our 19 board of directors are from outside of the United States. We also hold our large meetings in different regions of the world. People sometimes criticize us for saying, why are you going overseas to hold these meetings? Why don't you hold them in the United States? Well, the reason is very simple, that we're a global internet, and the people who need to participate in the business of ICANN are all over the world and can't all afford to travel to Marina del Rey.
Certainly so, makes sense to me.
Yeah, we want to make it easy for global participation. So we are a global organization. It's an essential part of what we do.
Would you say that the ICANN organization really runs the actual internet itself? And who kind of oversees the ICANN organization?
The answer to your first question is absolutely not. Someone said that asking the question, who runs the internet, is like asking who runs the international sidewalk program.
Yeah, that's right.
So the answer is no. The internet, by its very definition, is very diffuse and distributed. That's one of its great, great strengths historically. But there are certain things that need to be coordinated in some central way. And ICANN is dealing with those aspects that need to be coordinated as far as addressing and naming is concerned. So, no, we don't run the internet, and there are lots of things that ICANN is not involved in. For example, content questions and internet taxation, whatever it might be. So we're relatively well-defined in our scope, and we try to keep within our scope.
Well, that certainly begs the question, would the internet run without ICANN?
For a while. but pretty soon, conflicts would arise, and those conflicts would become more apparent, and the kinds of things we take for granted would probably not work very well. We'd also may well see a more litigious situation, and people being unable to agree on things they need to agree on.
That leads us into the next area here, which would be, you guys have been involved in resolving disputes within domain name owners, and is that expanding internationally? You guys getting involved in a lot of disputes, or are those things kind of dying down a little bit now?
Well, let's be a little clear about what our role is there.
Okay.
Issues of trademarks internationally, and this is what the dispute resolution policy is about. It's about a conflict in people using domain names which they may or may not be entitled to use them. These are intellectual property issues, and they come under the purview of the World Intellectual Property Organization. We have taken guidance from WIPO on the following question. Does every one of these disputes have to be resolved in the courts at great expense and a great delay, or can we set up mechanisms that, if both parties agree, that can resolve some of these disputes much more cheaply and much more quickly? And that's what the dispute resolution policy was all about. It was taking advice from WIPO, as it's called, on how to set up dispute resolution mechanisms that could be much faster and much cheaper without, by the way, jeopardizing either party's rights to resort to the courts any time they want. They don't have to accept the decision. But if they're both happy with the decision, or they both see that it's better to accept the decision than to spend large sums of money and have long delays in resolving the dispute, they take advantage of these mechanisms. ICANN's role has been to set up a number of what are called dispute resolution providers in various parts of the world who independently of ICANN provide this support to those who may have dispute about domain name. But beyond that, ICANN doesn't get involved. Parties either accept the decision or they go to court or they do whatever they want. But ICANN's fulfilled its role once it sets up these mechanisms. Make the job much easier, much cheaper.
who actually has the teeth when it comes to following through and forcing a party to give up their rights to a particular domain name, especially when you're dealing with an international environment. I'm sure there's different laws and different things that are going on there.
Well, exactly, and that's why either party has the right to resort to the court system in whatever region is appropriate or has jurisdiction, because these issues, as a matter of law, do vary around the world. The UDRP, Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, providers follow a set of guidelines that was recommended by WIPO and that which ICANN has as a requirement, and registrars, people who take your order for a domain name, are bound by their agreements with ICANN to honor the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy. The way it works is this. If you think that someone else is making abusive use of a name that you think properly you have trademark rights to, for example, you can file for a resolution with one of these UDRP providers. After going through a very careful process, these UDRP providers issue their ruling. If the losing party doesn't contest the result in the courts or whatever, then the registrars are bound to transfer the name, if that's the resolution, to the winning party. But if they compete in the contested courts, then everything's on hold until the courts. So it's a little complicated, but it fundamentally works. That doesn't mean that everybody's going to agree with every decision. It's fundamentally working very well.
And not everybody's going to be happy with the decisions, I'm sure.
Of course not. But they are happy with the fact they don't have to spend lots of money.
Yeah, that's true. How do you think that the new top-level domains are doing out there? And what's your thoughts on the future of more of them coming down the line?
Well, in some ways it's too early to tell, but I'm very encouraged by what I see. I think they've clearly opened up new spaces for people to register domain names and to provide meaningful alternatives to a large number of registrants. What's too early to tell is how that's going to grow, how it's going to develop, to what extent they're duplicating existing spaces. You know, we hope to be launching an evaluation soon, and following that evaluation, I think we'll have a much clearer idea. But I'm pleased to see that the 6 out of the 7 have launched successfully. I rather think that the business climate has obviously changed, and a lot of these were initially conceived, and I think that has perhaps changed not just their perspective, but the perspectives of others who might want to launch similar enterprises in the future. So I think we're going to have to sort of sit back and take a look at what happens and then make decisions on how to go forward.
We're having a conversation with Stuart Lin. He's president and CEO of the ICANN organization at ICANN.org, which stands for the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. Stuart's explaining ICANN's future role in the globalization of the Internet. We're taking a quick break, but we'll have more with Stuart on the other side. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
You're back and connected with the Web.Guys radio show.
We're in the middle of a conversation with Stuart Lin, the president and CEO of ICANN.org. Stuart's explaining ICANN's future role in the globalization of the Internet.
So what was the idea behind creating these new top-level domains? I mean, I'm sure you guys probably had a long-term view of this, of let's create different segmentation within the Internet based on individual domain names and actually force particular sites to have certain types of domain names. But do you see that as the long-term path of what's going on? It seems like the pull is so strong back to .com and .net that it's kind of preempted that. But do you see that in the long run of what needs to happen with the Internet to make the web more accessible?
Well, here's the scoop. Before we embarked on, let's say, on ICANN, there were a number of new, what we call generic top-level domains, like .com and .net, .org, and so on. And there are now about 240 what we call country code top-level domains, like .uk and .jp for Japan and so forth. So there's a very broad spectrum, but no new generic names have been launched in about 17 years since their initial inception in the mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were lots of people who think that we needed tens, hundreds, thousands of new top-level domains in order to create new business opportunities and to create more space for what people to register names when they couldn't get .com or whatever. there's an equal number of people who think that this will only cause consumer confusion, mm-hmm. and it won't solve the real problem because the business that's in .com will just have to register defensively in the new places in order to solve the problem. So the board decided to launch in November of 2000 what it called a proof of concept. So we're going to launch these seven new ones that exhibit different characteristics, and we're going to see how it goes. And what we learn from that will inform a more precise strategy for the future. Mm-hmm. We're talking about something that we don't know much about, so we better not get too precise too early, otherwise we might make mistakes which we'll later regret.
Certainly it appears that we only have about 10% of the world population online, and there's a lot of other opportunities out there that a lot of people are going to have a domain name. And I can definitely see a reason to have probably, in the long view, different top-level domains by different categories, and almost creating like a phone book.
Well, that's one view of the world. There are also technical problems that get in the way of that.
Yeah.
If you did too much of that, it could slow down the internet significantly.
Sure.
It's not a straightforward question, and it's not clear to a number of people that you cannot solve the problem that you mentioned within the existing framework. Other people think very differently, and I'd say it's an open question, and we're going to have to explore it as we move forward.
What would you say would be the state of the web and the internet right now from a global perspective? Just from a user perspective on my end, I don't find it really easy to find a lot of websites that are in other countries around the world, you know, using the basic search engines and those kind of things. What are you guys thinking about for the future to really make language and culture and websites more accessible to everybody in the world? Or is it going to be segmented because of language and culture?
Well, there's several questions that you raised there. The first is the internet is truly global. There are 500 million users worldwide or more, and that number is growing by leaps and bounds every day just because there are large parts of the world with large populations for which this is a new experience. But the percentage of users that are, for example, resident in the United States has steadily declined from almost 100% to I think it's probably under 40% today. Mm-hmm. Those numbers are hard to come by, but not precise, something like that. So we have a truly global internet. Mm-hmm. The problem you raised is one that is actually outside of ICANN's domain, which is how do you search and navigate how do you find things on the internet?
Mm-hmm.
And that's at the applications layer, and there are many ingenious ways of approaching that problem, but it's not a problem that ICANN explicitly deals with.
Okay.
In fact, interestingly enough, domain names were not introduced for the purpose of making it easier to search the internet. They were introduced to make it easier so you didn't have to put in some obscure number, a so-called IP address.
Yeah,
you could put in a name instead. It was a mnemonic device. So it's an interesting problem, but you raise another problem which is very important, which is something ICANN is worrying about, which is use of different languages and cultures and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the story there. First of all, as far as content is concerned, content now is almost in every language in the world. The key problem is, can you use domain names? Can you write domain names in other than the Roman character set, mm-hmm. so the one that we use in the English language, which is what is universally used in the domain name system? It's the so-called IDN or internationalized domain name problem. This is a very complicated problem that's very hot. There are large populations in the world for whom the Roman character set is either not their first natural thing to do, mm-hmm. or they don't know it at all.
Sure.
And so the question is, can you expand the domain name system to encompass other character sets?
Mm-hmm.
Technically very complicated. A lot of very bright people are working very hard on it. ICANN's been working on some of the policy issues surrounding it. Everybody that I know of recognizes the importance of the problem. Solutions are very tough, and we're gradually working our way forward.
We're having a conversation with Stuart Lin. He's president and CEO of the ICANN organization at ICANN.org. We're taking a quick break, but we'll have more with Stuart on the other side. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
You're still connected to the Web Talk Guys radio show. I'm Rob Greenlee, and Web Girl Dana's here.
We're in the middle of a conversation with Stuart Lin, the president and CEO of ICANN.org, which stands for the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers.
Let's talk a little bit about the organization of ICANN and some of the things that are being talked about out there about the ICANN organization. And I know you guys have been seeing some criticism from the media and a larger scope about having the board and the decision-making process being more open and more of a democratic type process. What are your thoughts on that, and what do you think the real issues are there?
Well, I think you have to be very careful when you use the term democratic.
Mm-hmm.
ICANN is not an exercise in global democracy.
Yeah.
ICANN has public participation,
mm-hmm.
is involving as many members of the community as possible in the work of ICANN. Now, there are a group of people who are very vocal and certainly get captured in the press.
Yeah.
We think the only way to do this is to have a global online election. This is a concept that at least now the board has rejected because we've tried it. It didn't work very well. The problems of ensuring there's no fraud and avoiding capture are enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Governments worldwide can't solve the problem with all the billions of dollars they spend on elections.
Yeah.
How can you expect little old ICANN to do that?
Yeah.
But that in no way, I want to emphasize that, in no way rejects the notion that the ICANN board feels very strongly that we've got to find other feasible ways to involve the public at large. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're working on now.
So is that the concept blueprint for reform?
That's one of the tasks.
Mm-hmm.
The blueprint for reform actually originated because I laid on the table in February something of a bombshell that said that although ICANN has been extraordinarily successful over the last 3 years, as we look to the challenges of the future, unless we change, I was very doubtful that we'd be able to move forward the way we want to. And I laid some fairly radical concepts on the table, largely to stimulate the community. The blueprint for reform is the result of 3 or 4 months' hard work by the community. Now, once you do that, there's a dynamic that occurs. Not everybody's going to be satisfied with everything. Those who like the status quo are going to continue to argue they weren't listened to, and that's really not the case. Translate that saying into, we didn't get exactly what we want. So they're going to translate that into saying, we're not democratic. The record just doesn't support that.
Sure. Does the ICANN organization have a strong connection with the UN, the United Nations?
Not with the United Nations per se. We have a government advisory committee to which any government in the world can credential a member, and the government advisory committee meets regularly at our meeting. One of the questions in the blueprint for reform is the extent to which that involvement and this reflection of the public interest, because governments, you know, are the most evolved form of representation. The UN is an international treaty organization. ICANN is not an international treaty organization. It was deliberately set up not to be, because the belief is that we needed a open participatory but private organization,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that we can move at internet speed.
So are you guys involved in the IP4 progression out there, and do you see that happening anytime soon where we can expand the IP numbers and be able to accommodate more domains?
Yeah, this comes under the area of so-called addressing policies, and that's one of the areas that we coordinate working very closely with the people who have the prime responsibility, which is the regional address registers, of which there are 3, hopefully soon to be 4, around the world. Those regional address registers have just issued and are bringing to ICANN a policy for how to move forward on the next generation, which is IPv6. IPv6 is already being used in all parts of the world, and I think most people feel that over the next few years, you're going to see a transition from IP version 4 to IP version 6.
What exactly does that look like? Is it going to add like maybe 2 characters or something like that?
No, it's actually a substantial expansion of the address space. You know, orders of magnitude. Some people think essentially limitless. We'll never run into any boundaries.
What kind of timing are you guys seeing for that next version to come out? I know it's going to require everybody to kind of upgrade their servers and those kind of things in order to support it.
Right. But. Well, first of all, it's already out. When will it pass the knee of the curve?
Mm-hmm.
When there's a strong perception among enough users that we're going to run out of space on IP version 4. People differ on exactly when that will be, but they think it's anywhere from the next 3 to 10 years. And so the transition will take place at that time.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on the push side. You know, what's the demand going to be for new domain names? Well, it's going to come from such things as, you know, mobile telephony on the internet. It's going to come from what some people see as internet appliances. Every refrigerator and every microwave oven and every little system inside your automobile is going to have its own domain name.
Well,
and as you said, the worldwide expansion.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're only reaching, 10% of the world population right now?
Well, exactly.
90% left to go.
Well, whether everyone has their own domain name or not remains seen.
Oh, yeah, I would
and
think
so, and
their
refrigerator, and their oven, and their... So, come on, we've got a long way to go yet.
That's right. Well, Stuart, it was great having you on the show.
Well, thank you, Rob, so much for inviting me, and anytime.
Well, I appreciate it. We've been speaking with Stuart Lynn, who's the president of ICANN at ICANN, that's ICANN.org. Go check out their site and see what they're up to, and I'm sure that there'll be ongoing announcements coming out of your organization, I'm sure, over the next few years. Take care, Stuart, and have a great weekend.
Thank you so much.
Stay connected, because in a moment we'll talk with San Francisco web designer and online community consultant Derek Powazik. He'll give us some tips on building a thriving online community from his book, Design for Community. This is Web Talk Guys Radio. As listeners to the Web Talk Guys radio show, I'm sure you're aware that companies that have an internet presence have in turn a great marketing strategy. Web Talk Guys website design service builds terrific business websites. Whether you're seeking a basic website or a revamp of your existing site, or maybe just someone to make periodic updates on your website, the Web Talk Guys website design service can assist you in developing a great face on the web. To learn more about the Web Talk Guys website design service special offer on site design or hosting, go to webtalkguys.com, click on web services, email us at info@webtalkguys.com, or you can give us a call at area code 253-640-0164. Web Talk Guys, not just radio guys, but also your total website solution.
Grab a board and surf the web with those crazy Web Talk Guys right here, right now.
You're back with the Web Talk Guys radio show. My name is Rob Greenlee, and Web Girl Dana's here.
You know, as more and more people gain access to the web, we seek out those like us, and we like to commune with those like us. So, of course, you'd think online communities on the internet are becoming very popular. They provide a place for like-minded individuals to come together regardless of their location, and they can share ideas and their dreams and our anxieties and problems.
So we've asked a web community expert, Derek Powazik, to join us on the show today from San Francisco. Derek is a web designer and web community consultant who has built interactive features on many sites and has watched them develop into flourishing communities on the web. Derek's written a book called Design for Communities, and it's published by New Writers Books. Derek, thanks for coming on the show with us.
Thank you.
Why don't you give us a little definition on what you consider a online community to be, or an e-community is what I like to coin it.
Well, let's see. I think it's not that different from figuring out if you're in a community in real life. Do you come to a group of people for support or guidance or help? Do you have a group of people who are important to you and feel like you belong with them? If so, you know, you may be part of a community. And the only thing that's happening that's new now is that sometimes those communities use internet tools to stay in touch with each other, whether they meet in real life or not. And when you have a virtual community like that, the rules change a little bit, but the core of it, that community feeling, is the same.
So when you actually decided to write this book on designing communities online, what was your premise behind that? What were you trying to get across to the reader?
Well, there were other books about virtual community, some of which really excellent, and some of which even came out before the web. Mm-hmm. Howard Reinhold's The Virtual Community springs to mind. But what I wanted to do was write a book that was specifically for designers. I'm a visual designer. I've always had kind of a visual brain way of thinking about things. And there wasn't really a book out there that talked to designers that said, okay, your boss just told you that you need to create a discussion space on your company's site. What does that look like? Because what I found in my experience designing these spaces is that what it looks like has a direct measurable effect on the kind of conversation you're going to create.
Sure.
That makes sense. Literally, sites with hard edges and shocking contrasty colors will produce a different kind of conversation when you open them up to general conversation on the web than a site with rounded corners or softer colors. You know, each of these things plays on people emotionally, and so when they go to respond and you give them that voice in a forum, they're going to respond, you know, in that environment.
Hmm.
The design of the spaces matters, and I wanted to write a book that was specifically about that.
Well, and you have quite a reputation out there, Derek, as a web designer. I think I read about someone saying about you that he could recognize a Derek site a mile away because of the style that you use. But also, the way you write, the style, not just the point of view of your book, is sort of different than other books. You sort of present stories and lessons that you've learned or stumbled across. Why don't you give us a typical example of something in your book and the style of writing that you do?
I'm a storyteller. Outside of my professional life, I run a site that's about personal storytelling called The Fray. And I found that the teachers I could think back in college that taught me a lot were the ones who used stories, not the ones who, you know, just said, do it my way because it's the right way. So I didn't want to write a book that was a kind of my way or the highway screed. So instead, I just wanted to tell stories about the things I'd learned and how I'd learned them so that by the end of the story, it's really, really obvious what I did wrong or right, and hopefully people can learn from that. One of the examples is in Chapter 5, for example, that talks about setting rules, policies, and policing.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about a time when someone posted something that I just didn't think was quite right to a community space, so I deleted it, and it was easy to do, and when you run a community, you have the power to delete things. So I just deleted it, and what he posted was, I like cheese. And it was off topic, and it didn't quite make any sense, so I just deleted it. It was easy to do, but then, you know, he came back, and he posted, I like cheese again, and I just thought, well, this is really annoying, so I kept deleting it. So then I banned him, because that's something else you can do when you run a community site. You can ban a user outright. So all his friends started showing up, and they, too, liked cheese. And it became the war of the cheese, and I had to, like, shut down the thread, and it became this, you know, this amazing thing. And what I learned from that was, okay, maybe the rules of procedure here in this community space that I thought were obvious are not so obvious. So maybe I need to communicate the rules better. Maybe I need to make some changes in the design so that the rules are more highlighted. Maybe I need to change the text of the rules to very specifically ban all discussion of lactose. I don't know, you know, something like that. Those are my favorite kinds of lessons, is when something happens so out of left field you could never have expected it.
Seems like it's kind of a power struggle in a way, because my involvement with online communities, at least in the chat rooms area, they can go off in all sorts of different kinds of directions. And I know the online moderator tries to control it, but oftentimes, because of the openness of the medium, it's hard to control the direction of a conversation.
Herding cats.
Yes.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's both its power and its curse. A friend of mine once said, the best thing about the web is that anyone can participate, and the worst thing about the web is that anyone can participate.
Yeah.
The issue then is, how do you kind of sculpt that raw power into something that tends to move in the direction you want it to? You can never make sure that nothing goes wrong. Something will always go wrong. But how do you make it so that the correct path, the path you want to encourage your users down, is the convenient downhill path? And if they want to make trouble, they're going to have to work uphill a little bit for it.
How would you suggest that a moderator or somebody running an online community kind of funnel the topic so it stays on track? I know I've seen it done a little bit where you kind of seed the conversation with different topics versus just letting it run rampant. But what's your thought on that?
Well, there's lots of different techniques depending on the kind of site you're running. The best few in general terms are using content liberally. So instead of just having a discussion tool sitting out there by itself with no guidance,
mm-hmm.
put out a piece of example content.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do at Fray.com. The example content is a personal story, and then the users are invited to respond with a personal story of their own. Well, sometimes those personal stories are 12 pages long. So if you've read to the end, that means that you have cared about the story, and you probably have a story to tell in response.
Yeah, that's true.
If you can't get to the end of the story, then you probably have nothing to say, and that's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things to remember here is that not everybody needs to participate in every thread in every community.
Yeah.
Everybody will find a niche for themselves, and if you lose interest, sometimes interest level can be a great barrier to entry. Other things are, if you're in a more general community space, for example, and you're talking about ducks, this is the duck community area, we're going to talk about ducks, and people keep coming in and saying, you know, swans are cool, I really like swans. And I go, no. And if you find yourself 12 times a day having to say, no, we're talking about ducks, maybe what you need to do is create a separate swan area, and everybody's got their spot.
Uh-huh.
That can be a very effective technique, too.
Hey, Derek, how easy is it for someone to set up a community feature? Actually, what tools you mentioned earlier can you use to develop a community area? Do we need to hire you to do that?
Yes, you need to hire me. No, there's plenty of tools out there that run the gamut from something you can set up on somebody else's server in 5 minutes to something that's going to cost you $100,000 and, you know, several large expensive pieces of equipment. For people who have a website and don't have any community tools and don't have a lot of money to spend and want to just dip their toe in it to see if it works, you can use some free web-based tools. Yahoo Groups, groups.yahoo.com has a free service where you can start what's essentially a mailing list with a web component.
Mm-hmm.
So people could join your group and then each of them can send email to all the others, or they could opt to just read it online. There's also a website called communityzero.com that has a host of some pretty impressive community tools, mostly web-based discussion, that you can just go sign up. In both these cases, your design options are limited. So you're not going to be able to integrate it with your own site. You're not going to be able to make it look like your brand. You know, that's the trade-off of it being free. But that, those are a great places to get your feet wet and start to build a community. And then you can ask your community, well, how do you guys like it here? I'm thinking about doing something else. Give me some feedback. And then you might want to go there. If you decide to go past that, there are a lot of free community tools that you can install on your own server.
Mm-hmm.
The cost that comes in there then is if you, say, don't know how to hack Perl, for example, you can download a free... there's plenty of free community tools that you can download and use, but you may have to hire someone to install it and
to actually put it in there,
design it to match your site.
Just contact Derek for that.
What tools out there are you seeing are the most successful at building communities right now? Is it going to Yahoo Groups, or is it using a chat function, Java? What's the tool that's really garnering the biggest attention online right now?
In the most general sense, I'd have to say instant messaging has taken over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a community tool in the broad sense of the word, in that it's given all the power to the user. There is no central site administrator who's dealing with it. But mostly that's person-to-person communication. And while that's powerful, when I'm setting up my initial definition of what community means in the book, one of the pieces of that definition is that it's public. So you're talking to more than one person. You're talking to a group. So if we edge out instant messaging, because usually you can use some instant messaging tools to talk to groups, but usually they're person to person.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting areas of growth in the last year has been weblogs.
Mm-hmm.
Weblogs are usually just a website where a person can post an entry to the top of the page and it kind of stays fresh. But what's happened is weblogs have expanded to include community features, comments, group weblogs where several people post. And they become really focus areas for a particular niche.
Yeah.
So there's like ShowTunes weblogs or Buffy the Vampire Slayer weblogs. I think one of the mistakes that a lot of old people trying to use community made was that they just put out a tool with no content and said, talk about racetracks here. And then people would get there and go, well, I like racetracks, but I don't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go away. So instead, when you have a weblog, then you have too much content because you're posting every day. And people naturally want to talk back. So there's this natural flow from people sending you email to people wanting to post something to the page. And then it's a very easy step from there, and I think that's where weblogs need to go, to a membership system where we go, okay, we're really going to be a community here. You've got to sign up for a membership. You have an investment. No longer me talking to you. It's us talking to each other.
We're having a conversation with Derek Kowalczyk, who's author of the book Design for Community. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
The Web Talk Guys are thrilled to be your radio hosts, but we'd also be thrilled to host your website, too. The Web Talk Guys website hosting service combines a high-speed, dedicated internet connection and the marketing power of a link from the show's website to help you. We offer all the standard hosting stuff for a very low, limited-time hosting price of only $10 a month for the first 3 months. To learn more, go to webtalkguys.com and click on Web Services or email info@webtalkguys.com. You can reach us by calling area code 253-640-0164. Web Talk Guys, not just your radio hosts, but also your total hosting solution.
Don't you know who we are?
You web guys rock!
Gather around, webheads. Listen and learn.
We're having a conversation with Derek Kowalczyk, who is author of the book Design for Community, and he's filling us in on all sorts of e-community tips.
Derek, I just wanted to find out who really isn't doing a very good job at community, or who made some big community blunders out there, because it's really hard to fail and not have everybody notice when you're running a community.
Well, you know what's funny? The book that I published last year, Design for Community, started as a series of talks that I gave at web conferences. I think I started doing the talk in about 98. A full half of my talk was doing exactly this, was pointing at people who were doing it wrong. And audiences loved it because they love it when you can say, like, here's CNN and look how badly they suck, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's not the most positive thing, but
no,
people like to hear that. It's just like people like to see train wrecks.
That, yeah, well, and it was educational too because I could say, well, here's how I would do it to do it better, and people learn from that, hopefully. But the funny part is, in the few years since then, they've all either stopped doing it wrong or started doing it better to the extent that I can't make fun of them anymore. And I'm really upset about it because my talk is less interesting now. But CNN was somebody I'd always point at because they had just huge amounts of boards. They were, you know, the world leader in news, right? So people would come there with a chip on their shoulder, ready to make some trouble and wanting to be, you know, as popular as the news leads and such. They've ended their community boards. They just pulled the plug.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't have ended it. I would have tried to make some personal guides, some better navigation about who's discussing what where. I would have tied it into the content more. But they just decided, well, this is too much trouble. Motley Fool, similarly, a financial magazine.
Yeah, we're familiar with, sure.
They've gated them and put up a price tag. You have to pay to enter now.
Oh, dear.
Oh, really?
While at first that seems like, you know, counter to the whole internet wonderfulness of community that everybody can come and play for free. What's interesting about it is I just read an interview. Now that the company has a financial incentive to bring new voices into the community,
mm-hmm.
they're actually working to improve them and working to get more people in them and spending more time in them. Whereas before, when they were free, they were, what's the business term, a loss leader?
Yeah, they were neglected and not taken care of, right?
They were neglected, and yeah. every new member that was met with kind of a groan, like, oh my God, here's one more person who's going to push us closer to the brink, because we have to spend money on every user. Well, when you flip that and make people pay a small amount, then you have a financial interest in improving the communities. I find that very interesting. Now, not all communities can do that, mm-hmm. but if they can do it and make it work, and Salon has done that too, and if Salon can do it and make it work, then I think we could show that places that are offering something that nobody else is offering can do this and can be self-supporting, and that would be really nice.
Derek, just in the last minute or two that we have left, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you did at South by Southwest and how people can contact you?
South by Southwest, I've been going for the last 6 or 7 years. And so I went through the phase where it was all like big money guys and big suits talking big plans. And then there was the last couple of years that were slightly depressing. Reporters would show up and go, so does any of this still matter? yes, I think. So this year, I think it's a smaller conference. It's a more humble conference. We've been through the fire. And people are still excited about creating stuff. This year was one of the most positive, wonderful years that I can remember. I did lots of things. There was a track of panels this year that was sponsored by Independence Day, which is a group of websites devoted to promoting independent content. Josh Davis from PrayStation and Jeffrey Zeldman from Zeldman.com and Gabe from Born Magazine. And that was really cool because South by Southwest is one of the only conferences where you could have a panel like this. A bunch of people talking about what they do for free, you know, because they love the web and they want to put things out there.
Yeah.
We also had Frey Cafe, which was a live storytelling night. Some feature performers and some people who just showed up and then took part. We have all 4 hours of the audio online at frey.org now. I did a book reading for Design for Community that was sponsored by the publisher New Writers. Reading from a tech book is always kind of interesting. Thankfully, there's a few stories in there that make for good reading.
Oh, sure.
And I led a Design for Community panel with three of the folks who I interviewed in the book. It was called The User's Strike Back. It was all about, you know, what to do about problem users and how to avoid when things go wrong.
Well, tell us, Derek, how we can look at your work and get in contact with, is it Frey.com and then the San Francisco stories?
My sites are all linked from my kind of personal portal at powazek.com, P-O-W-A-Z-E-K.com. And if you're interested in the book, it's designforcommunity.com. And there's excerpts from every chapter as well as discussions about the content of the book there.
Design for Community, that's at New Writer Books. We're talking with Derek Powazek, the author of designforcommunity.com. Thank you so much, Derek, for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Web.Guys Radio.
And I'm Web Girl Dana.
And my name is Rob Greenlee, and we hope to have you back with us again next week. I'll see you around the net.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys.
Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.